resentment during the winter. This generalized, faintly self-pitying resentment against millions of people he did not know. He did know his father, however, and so they were not getting along well now. In a way, this was Finney's view, except that naturally, he saw it comically, as a huge, intensely practical joke, played by fat and foolish old men bungling away behind the scenes. I could never agree with either of them. It would have been comfortable, but I could not believe it, because it seemed clear that wars were not made by generations and their special stupidities, but that wars were made instead by something ignorant in the human heart. Brinker went upstairs to continue his packing, and I walked over to the gym to clean out my locker. As I crossed the far common, I saw that it was rapidly becoming unrecognizable, with huge green barrels placed at many strategic points, the ground punctuated by white markers identifying offices and areas, and also certain less tangible things, a kind of snap in the atmosphere, a professional optimism, a conscious maintenance of high morale. I myself had often been happy at Devon, but such times it seemed to me that afternoon were over now. Happiness had disappeared, along with rubber, silk, and many other staples, to be replaced by the wartime synthetic high morale for the duration. At the gym, a platoon was undressing in the locker room. The best that could be said for them physically was that they looked wiry in their startling sets of underwear, which were the color of moss. I never talked about Phineas, and neither did anyone else. He was, however, present in every moment of every day since Dr. Stampole had told me. Finney had a vitality which could not be quenched so suddenly, even by the marrow of his bone. That was why I couldn't say anything or listen to anything about him, because he endured so forcefully that what I had to say would have seemed crazy to anyone else. I could not use the past tense, for instance. And what they had to say would be incomprehensible to me. During the time I was with him, Phineas created an atmosphere in which I continued now to live, a way of sizing up the world with erratic and entirely personal reservations, letting its rock-like facts sift through and be accepted only a little at a time, only as much as he could assimilate without a sense of chaos and loss. No one else I have ever met could do this. All others at some point found something in themselves pitted violently against something in the world around them. With those of my year, this point often came when they grasped the fact of the war, when they began to feel that there was this overwhelmingly hostile thing in the world with them. Then the simplicity and unity of their characters broke, and they were not the same again. Phineas alone had escaped this. He possessed an extra vigor, a heightened confidence in himself, a serene capacity for affection which saved him. Nothing as he was growing up at home, nothing at Devon, nothing even about the war had broken his harmonious and natural unity. So at last, I had. The parachute rigger sprinted out of the hallway toward the playing fields. From my locker I collected my sneakers, jockstrap, and gym pants, and then turned away, leaving the door ajar for the first time. Forlornly open and abandoned, the locker unlocked. This was more final than the moment when the headmaster handed me my diploma. My schooling was over now. I walked down the aisle past the rows of lockers, and instead of turning left toward the exit leading back to my dormitory, I turned right and followed the Army Air Force out into the playing fields of Devon. A high wooden platform had been erected there, and on it stood a barking instructor, giving the rows of men below him calisthenics by the numbers. This kind of regimentation would fasten itself on me in a few weeks. I no longer had any qualms about that, although I couldn't help being glad that it would not be at Devon, anywhere like Devon, that I would have that. I had no qualms at all. In fact, I could feel now the gathering, glowing sense of sureness in the face of it. I was ready for the war, now that I no longer had any hatred to contribute to it. My fury was gone. I felt it gone. Dried up at the source, withered and lifeless. Phineas had absorbed it and taken it with him, and I was rid of it forever. The PT instructor's voice, like a frog's croak amplified 100 times, blared out the Army's numerals.
Ha-tu-hee-har!
Behind me as I started back toward the dormitory. And my feet, of course, could not help but begin to fall involuntarily into step with that coarse, compelling voice, which carried to me like an air raid siren across the fields and commons. They fell into step then, as they fell into step a few weeks later under the influence of an even louder voice and stronger sun. Down there, I fell into step as well as my nature, Phineas filled, would allow. I never killed anybody, and never developed an intense level of hatred for the enemy, because my war ended before I ever put on the uniform. I was on active duty all my time at school. I killed my enemy there. Only Phineas never was afraid. Only Phineas never hated anyone. Other people experienced this fearful shock somewhere, this sighting of the enemy, and so began an obsessive labor of defense, began to parry the menace they saw facing them by developing a particular frame of mind. "You see," their behavior toward everything and everyone proclaimed, "I am a humble ant. I am nothing. I am not worthy of this menace." Or else, like Mr. Ludsbury, "How dare this threaten me? I'm much too good for this sort of handling. I shall rise above this." Or else, like Quackenbush, "Strike out at it always and everywhere." Or else, like Brinker, develop a careless general resentment against it. Or else, like Leper, emerge from a protective cloud of vagueness, only to meet it, the horror, face to face, just as he had always feared, and so give up the struggle absolutely. All of them, all except Phineas, constructed at infinite cost to themselves these Maginot lines against this enemy they thought they saw across the frontier, this enemy who never attacked that way, if he ever attacked at all, if he was, indeed, the enemy. You have been enjoying an audio bookshelf production of A Separate Piece by John Knowles and narrated by Scott Snively. For more information on this or any other audio bookshelf production, call 1-800-234-1713. Go online to audiobookshelf.com or write Audio Bookshelf, 174 Prescott Hill Road, Northport, Maine, 04849. A Separate Piece, copyright 1959 by John Knowles. A Separate Piece recording copyright 2002, Audio Bookshelf. Used by permission of Curtis Brown Limited, New York, New York. All rights reserved. Copying this production for any reason is strictly forbidden.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.